This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Wednesday, April 24th. $60 billion in desperately needed aid is headed for Ukraine after a months-long struggle in Washington. We'll talk to Ukraine's ambassador to Canada about whether it's enough to turn the tide of war. And Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre is drawing some attention after making a stop at an anti-carbon tax protest in Atlantic Canada. We'll talk through how this all unfolded, and the Power panel is here with their take. Plus, TikTok's Chinese owner has 9 months to sell the popular social media app or risk a ban in the United States. What's the likelihood of this happening, and could this campaign spread to Canada? We begin today with the big news from the United States, where President Joe Biden approved more than a $60 billion military aid package to help Ukraine's fight against Russia. After months of delay, a sweeping majority of the Senate passed the bill yesterday in a 79-18 vote.
In the next few hours, literally the few hours, we're going to begin sending in equipment to Ukraine for air defense munitions, for artillery, for rocket systems and armored vehicles.
For months now, Ukraine has been suffering from artillery shell shortages while Russian forces were able to advance their attack. Yulia Kovalev is Ukraine's ambassador to Canada, and she joins me now. Ambassador, it's good to have you back. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been stalled for months. I know you've been anxious about this. What's your reaction now that it's finally passed and the president is sending aid to your country?
Of course, like, it's a very important step from United States, our core ally and supporter, and the speed of the announcement just a few hours after the bill was signed, U.S. government announced $1 billion worth of the new military support package, which also includes the missiles for air defense, the artillery, the armored vehicles, those which are of a huge need, as now Ukraine for months has been feeling a shortage of munition. Unfortunately, our troops were withdrawn from Avdiivka because actually we were feeling this short of munition. And of course, it's very important support on the front line for the soldiers. It's also like increasing the morale of the people in the country who are suffering every day from Russian missiles. Almost every day there are the launch of the drones, missiles. 80% of our thermal power plant, as we discussed lately, have been destroyed. So we really value and grateful for the support, bipartisan support in U.S. and the support of people of America for this huge supplementary bill that was just voted.
So $60 billion today, and the president said that when he signed it, that within hours the aid would start to flow. And you say $1 billion in artillery and ammunition is already on the way. So how significant is this aid package at this point in the war? I mean, as you said, your country had to pull out of Avdiivka because they just couldn't spare the munitions to fight back. Your electric infrastructure is being overwhelmed because of a lack of air defense. Where does this put you now?
Of course, it's important. It's together. It's also like just yesterday, UK announced the biggest in the history, the support, the package of from UK worth of £500 million. Mm-hmm. That also includes the missiles, the artillery shells. We need to understand what Russia is trying to do. They are trying to push and use this momentum as the military support is still on the way to get some gains on the front line. So, of course, the quick delivery of the support and part of that from the U.S. package is already in Europe. So we will be talking about the days to deliver that to Ukraine. That's very crucial for us.
It's obviously a crucial a jolt of assistance at a difficult time in the conflict. But some Ukrainian officials, I believe even Foreign Minister Kuleba, were saying that the restoration of the military won't be enough to defeat Russia. I mean, what more does your country need at this point to push back against the gains they've made?
Of course, like the first thing that we has been talking for already a few weeks, it's the air defense system. Mm-hmm. That's to protect the cities for civilian population. And we have the good news. Germany already announced that they are sending the one Patriot system to Ukraine. We are working among the allies to get more. But also, if we are talking about the front line, if you ask the soldier or the ask the people who are now in the process of training to go to the front line, of course, like, for them, it's scary to be mm-hmm. almost naked if they don't have the weapons to fight. So this is the this packages of support, and we see how quick was the reaction from U.S. Just few hours, and the package was announced, and the things are now moving to Ukraine. That's, I think, a good example among all of the allies to follow.
Ihor Michael Chishin from the Ukrainian Canadian Congress was here last night, and he spoke about the challenges your soldiers are having because Russia has riddled your country with landmines. And this is an enormous challenge for them, you know, for infantry to move on. And he says what you need is air power. You need the airplanes to get up and running to be able to push back and have that level of control. I mean, is that what your country needs most at this point?
Of course, like what is in this war for over 2 years is that Ukraine don't have the superiority in the air because of the lack of the fighter jets. Mm-hmm. Today, our pilots are being trained, and we are grateful for the countries who have already committed to provide Ukraine with F-16 fighter jets. Of course, that will be a significant support of our troops on the ground being covered from the air with the modern fighter jets. They are still not in Ukraine. The training is ongoing. The preparation are there, but we hope that this year they will be mm-hmm. in Ukrainian sky protecting our soldiers and helping them to advance and regain the territories. Regarding the mines, indeed, Ukraine today is the most polluted by mines country in the world. So that both is linked to our agri-fields, mm-hmm. which are contaminated with the mines. And also it put the challenge to the soldiers to move further because Russia significantly mined those. And we also understand that Canada has few of those armored vehicles that can be used for the mining. And that is one of the things we are talking and asking from Canada to help us with that.
Okay, so Canada has some demining vehicles they could maybe provide to Ukraine. I know there has been a promise that has been unfulfilled to buy a NASAM, an advanced air defense system for Ukraine, and because of just procurement and construction challenges, that hasn't arrived. There has been a request made for Canada to purchase missiles, air defense system, anything they can, even hand over surplus armored vehicles that could be not fully operational because your people will make them work. What's your sense of getting a jolt of military support from Canada, whether it's buying ammunition, buying missiles, providing old armored vehicles, or giving you these demining vehicles?
David, I would say that I will be the most happiest person if I will come to you, visit your show, and share the great news that either the missiles or ammunition or these armed vehicles will be delivered to Ukraine. Let's hope it will be soon.
Are there any indications that our government is thinking about doing that here in Canada?
We actually have quite often the meetings with DND and the other agencies involved. They are fully aware about our urgent need. They are fully aware about the pressing situation on the front line. And we do hope and believe that overwhelming Canadians understand that Ukraine is fighting for all of us, is fighting against Russia, who is now the biggest threat to NATO, who is actually Canada's neighbor in the mm-hmm. Arctic. So, you know, the this is not only our fight for our country, that is a fight for all of us as the Western democracies, and we hope that the decisions will be, and the implementation of the decisions will be done quick.
Canada obviously can't match the military support a country like the United States or even the United Kingdom can provide, just given the nature of our military. But they have tried to lead the way on sanctions. This is something that the government has prided itself on. And we see a report from Reuters today, Ambassador, that Airbus has been granted a waiver to allow it to use Russian titanium by the Canadian government in its manufacturing and shipping of its European-made jets into this country, that Canada has given Reuters this waiver to use Russian titanium. What are your thoughts on that report?
It's very disturbing. We reached to Global Affairs of Canada to get some information about it. And you need to understand what it is, what we are talking about. We are talking about a company which is called Avesma, which is the one of the core of Russian military industry. So Kalibr missiles, MiG-35 and Su-35 fighter jets, everything is built from the titanium, which is supplied by Avesma. I will show you the picture. This is the picture from Vinnytsia. 2 years ago. The seven-year-old kid was killed by this caliber missile. Many more kids were killed by these missile strikes over the 2 years. They have been built by using Avisma titanium. For these 2 years of the war, the export from Russia of the critical minerals, including titanium, overreached $13 billion of U.S. dollars. It's more than Canadian support to Ukraine for these 2 years, including the loans that Canadian government provided to us. And this is the core of Russian war machine. We heard back at the end of December 2022 publicly from the CEO of Airbus that was released in the media that it will take the company months, not a year, to replace Russian titanium. We are already 2 years, over 2 years in a full-scale war. So is it not enough time? Shall we continue to pay Russian war machine billions of dollars and on the other side use the budget money to help Ukraine in the military? I think this is not a rhetoric question. That is the reality. If we want Russia to stop and to stop Russian war machine, 2 years, it's totally enough. We already had this discussion 2 years ago, and there were a lot of calls from European companies that they cannot survive without the Siemens turbine. We are 2 years after that, almost. It seems like we can. It seems like, and Europe has done a tremendous progress to deprive from dependency of Russian gas, including, the first of all, the pipeline gas. I think this was a very sober example that the things can be done. If there is a will and there is the real understanding that we cannot grant additional billions of dollars into Russian war machine. And that also, I think, the company, it promised almost a year and a half ago that it will take them the months. And so where are they now? Is it okay for the company to understand that this titanium is killing the children in Ukraine, innocent children?
Just as a final question, did you get any explanation from the government of Canada?
We don't have. So that's why I can't comment, because I don't have enough information to comment whether it's true or not. But I'm just trying to explain what is that? What is at stake? This is the huge Russian military support, the conglomerate which Ukraine was advocating for months and years that they need to be sanctioned. We need to deprive from that dependency. There was a tremendous success in the energy and critical minerals, and especially for Canada, the country who has a lot of critical minerals, including the critical minerals like titanium. This is the way how we need to act together. We can't let us to be compromised with our values.
Ambassador Kovalev, thank you so much for your time today. We always appreciate it. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre is drawing some attention after making a stop at an anti-carbon tax protest in Atlantic Canada.
So you guys are here 24-7?
Yep, 24-7.
Okay. And so when I ask the tax, then you guys are going to be able to go home.
Right on.
Poilievre visited a group of protesters last night who are camped out at the New Brunswick, Nova Scotia border. Some of them took videos, and they contained some strong language and some strong opinions, and that's led to some strong political language and political opinions today. The CBC's Karina Rome has been watching all of that, and she joins me in the studio today. So, Karina, a lot of moving parts in this. Take us through how this all unfolded with what we saw in that video.
Okay, so as you said, Pierre Poilievre visited this group of people who are protesting the carbon tax. It's alongside the highway on the border between Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. It's part of an Atlantic tour that he's doing. Now, the protesters have been camped there for weeks. You can see in the video when they explain they are staying in trailers and camper vans and even their cars. Also in the videos, you can see flags we've become more familiar with, such as the F. Trudeau flags, yep. The upside-down Canadian flags. I don't know whether people saw there, but on the door of the trailer in that video, there's also a hand-drawn Diagonal. Oh, there it is, yes. Diagonal sign. For those not familiar, that is a far-right group that some might remember from... That the convoy is when a lot of people became first familiar with that group. Some of these people's social media pages show that they have been participants in the convoy, in the parental rights movement and protests. So Polyev listens to their concerns and what they have to say and how their protest has been going. And I now need to warn everyone, because we'll play a little bit of a video of what he said about Justin Trudeau to them. And it does contain some strong language, but people can have a listen.
I had heard about you guys on the news, and then we were traveling to Nova Scotia tonight to Stellarton from PEI, and we saw you. So I told the team, let's pull over and say hello.
Probably negative, all you hear on the news, but that's to be expected.
No, everyone's outside. Everyone's happy with what you're doing.
Really?
Fighting
that's
against
awesome
the,
to hear.
The tax. Everyone hates the tax.
Yeah.
Because everyone's been screwed over, right?
Oh, they
believe, people believed his lies. Everything he said was bull top to bottom. Everything he said. He was going to help the middle class. The middle class is the working poor now.
So that was part of what he said about the Prime Minister. And then he toured one of the trailers, as you saw in an earlier video, and took some pictures with people, asked them to take pictures with, well, they asked him to take pictures with them. And then the video ends eventually.
Okay, so, you know, liberals and supporters of the government seized on this. The Prime Minister was asked about this today in particular. The word we had to beep, you know, because this is a supper time show here in Central Canada. But he was asked about being called a liar and a BSer. What did Justin Trudeau have to say about that?
So, yeah, he was asked basically, here's what was said. What is your reaction? So we'll play some of that reaction.
Every politician has to make choices about what kind of leader they want to be. Are they a kind of leader that is going to exacerbate divisions, fears, and polarization in our country, make personal attacks, and welcome the support of conspiracy theorists and extremists? Because that's exactly what Pierre Poilievre continues to do, not just when you see him engaging with members of Diagolon, but also when he refuses to condemn and reject the endorsement of Alex Jones. Alex Jones is a proven liar and conspiracy theorist who, you know, has to pay millions, hundreds of millions of dollars because he lied about the Sandy Hook killing that killed 20 little kids.
Now, that was part of what he said. Mm-hmm. There was more. We're not going to play the whole thing, but he did go on to say this, so have a listen to the other part.
The fact that Pierre Poilievre hasn't stood up to condemn that endorsement, the fact that he continues to encourage the kind of divisive approaches to Canada that I don't think Canadians want to see, really shows that he will do anything to win, anything to torque up negativity and fear. And it only emphasizes that he has nothing to say to actually solve the problems that he's busy amplifying.
Now, Jagmeet Singh, the NDP leader, was also asked for his reaction. He also gave a fairly long answer, and so we have part of that for our viewers. Have a listen.
A leader shouldn't be someone that is irresponsible with language, that stokes division, that stokes hatred. He doesn't care about people. He doesn't care about workers. He just cares about power, and he'll do anything it takes to divide Canadians, to hurt people, to get there.
Okay, so Karina, the Liberals and the NDP have criticized Pierre Poilievre for his association with the convoy protests in the past, for what they say is too cozy a relationship with extreme groups, and for failing to rebuke the endorsement of Alex Jones, which is something that they've been pushing on social media. So we haven't had an interview or anything with Pierre Poilievre today, but we have heard from him. What is he saying about the scrutiny he's facing after this stop in Atlantic Canada?
CBC did reach out to the Conservatives for their reaction, and we did get a statement from the spokesperson for the opposition leader's office. So they say that on the drive between events in Atlantic Canada, that he noticed this anti-carbon tax protests. And obviously, he's a vocal opponent, as we know, to that tax. And so he made a brief impromptu stop. He also pushes back at the idea of what an extremist is in this statement. And then he says, in terms of the Alex Jones allegations, he says something he's actually sort of said before as well. We do not follow the individual you mention or listen to what he has to say. They say instead that they're listening to the priorities of millions of Canadians who agree with them about such things as axing the tax, and says it is the endorsement of hardworking everyday Canadians that Conservatives are working to earn, and that they're not paying attention to what some American is saying, and unlike, they say, the Prime Minister, who they say is paying attention to that. So that is the statement. As you said, he has distanced himself previously as well to Alex Jones, as an example, who has said that he admires Pierre Poilievre, who has said, I believe, that he's saying the same things that I'm saying, is what Jones has said. So he has distanced himself, but he hasn't outright disavowed him. So certainly that's something that, as well, the Liberals continue to seize upon that distinction.
Okay. All right, Karina, thanks so much. We're going to talk about this on the Power Panel, but Karina, thank you for walking us through this today. Pierre Poilievre's roadside stop at a carbon tax protest camp is in the spotlight today. While speaking to the group, Poilievre claimed Trudeau, the Prime Minister, is lying about, quote, everything. Trudeau responded, accusing Poilievre of welcoming, quote, extremists. That's after Poilievre was filmed exiting an RV at the camp with a drawing of the Diaghilom flag on the door. And Diaghilom has been described as a far-right extremist group.
Every politician has to make choices about what kind of leader they want to be. Are they a kind of leader that is going to exacerbate divisions, fears, and polarization in our country, make personal attacks, and welcome the support of conspiracy theorists and extremists?
Meanwhile, Poilievre's official spokesperson said it was an impromptu stop at an anti-carbon tax protest, saying if Justin Trudeau is concerned about extremism, he should look at parades on Canadian streets openly celebrating Hamas's slaughter of Jews on October 7th. Here to weigh in on this is our Wednesday Power Panel. Amanda Alvaro is a former Liberal Party communications strategist. Freelance journalist Justin Ling joins us tonight. And here with me in studio, Tim Powers is a former strategist for conservative parties, and Jordan Leichnitz is a former NDP strategist. Hello to you all. Justin, I would like to start with you, because you've done a lot of reporting on the protest subcurrents here in this country and the composition of issues that sort of are manifesting at these things. Put this in context, this decision by Pierre Poilievre to go speak with this group, and should he have anticipated pushback from his political rivals by going there?
Yeah, I mean, let's start with the second part, because obviously, yes, that's why he did it, right? I mean, to some degree, he called on these protests to happen, right? He was desperate to try and re-energize the sort of grassroots activism that defined the Freedom Convoy. He wants to use that kind of, that sort of energy, which is not normally, something that the conservatives can benefit from. He wants to use that sort of, that grassroots anger and frustration to his own benefit. He called for this to happen. These encampments set up, they have representation from extremist groups like Diaghilom, from sovereign citizen groups who think that the law doesn't apply to them, but also from a whole constellation of people with grievances, some legitimate and some not. So he knew exactly what he was going into, and he was waiting for Trudeau to call him out, because he gets to sort of ask people to pick a side. Are you with me or are you with Mr. Trudeau? Now, The climate and as a whole, this protest movement, they've been looking for another issue to glob onto after the Freedom Convoy. In some interviews with some of the organizers, some live streams, they've even been really upfront. They've been looking for an issue to rally around, and the carbon tax became a really useful one. There was one quote that I thought was really interesting. One of them even said they've been looking for something that can really express the accumulation of hate they have towards this government. And right now, that's the carbon tax.
So Jordan, on that point, the pushback from the conservatives is that, look, they're just there. They're protesting the same public policy thing that I dislike, and that's why I'm going there. He has been, Pierre Poilievre, caught in moments with Diaghilev members in the past, and he always said, I had no idea who this guy was. But over the years, there have been multiple encounters or intersections between that movement and his life, and that we saw this drawing on the door. I don't know if he saw it or not. But at some of these protests, this is a feature, not a bug. And he still goes there. How should we interpret that, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think, this is fool me once, shame on you. But he's been fooled apparently now three or four times. So no, this is not accidental at all. And of course, I think what Justin mentioned is really important. Like, you can draw a straight line between some of the groups that are involved in these anti-carbon tax protests and the sort of the energy and the convoy, right? Like, this is, it's the same groups of people who are now reorganizing around the carbon tax. And so that includes, like, as is now well known, and we had the entire Rouleau Commission that went into this. This includes groups that are far-right groups that are white supremacist groups, and some groups, including Diaghilev, that were found to be armed at the Kutz border blockade. So it's well known that when you are finding these carbon tax protests, that you would have some of these fellow travelers that are really, really problematic. And I think that this wasn't really a good day for Pierre Poilievre, because, of course, nobody now is discussing the carbon tax. They're discussing whether he's flirting with extremists again. So that's not really serving him either at the political level.
Tim, so what conclusions can anybody draw from this, right? Because, you saw the version of events laid out there by the Prime Minister and Jagmeet Singh, that they're cozying up and playing footsie with groups that may have voted for Max Bernier in the past, is sort of the political theory on it, and they want to get them back and lock them into the conservative base. And Mr. Poilievre saying, these are just people who are suffering from the punitive tax policy of the government. What can you draw from what he's doing there?
Having lived in that region, and Justin will know it well too, he picked the wrong stop. He should have gone down to the Irving Big Stop in Amherst and met some people at the restaurant there, and would have had a better audience with an audience that wouldn't be causing him the problem that it's having today. I don't know what the motivation is, other than perhaps a sense that he can push the envelope as hard as he likes and draw out some people, as Justin talked about. The challenge with that approach right now is he doesn't need to do it, right? He doesn't need to do this. In fact, he could go away for a week or two and let the narrative of the budget that's not taking off, as pollsters are saying, play out. I mean, this is the thing he's going to have to learn to manage as we get closer to an election campaign. This will not last. This story will pass. Maybe there's some advance work that could be better there. I don't know. I don't know if it was deliberate or not. But if this is to happen in an election campaign when more people are watching, it's probably more problematic than it is today. I think part of the DNA of Pierre that has worked for Pierre is he's hard going. He goes at it all the time. He never stops running. He has looked at past conservative election failures and said, people didn't keep up the pressure. They didn't look after the voters and others that we perhaps should have spoken to. I think sometimes you got to take your foot off the gas. Go to the big stop, not to this particular encampment.
But, Amanda, he did go there, and it was live streamed, as everything is at these protests now. And you can see, even in the interactions, his risk aversion of a man wants to take a picture with him in front of one of the Duck Trudeau signs, and he refuses to do that and says, come over here, we'll do it over here, because he doesn't want to be standing in front of that flag in a picture that's going to go places. But what do you make of this choice to do this and what we saw in those interactions?
Well, for sure, nobody's buying the idea that they were sort of just trucking along and saw a little protest and thought, oh, we'll get out because here's a nice little photo op. Like, anyone who's been in government or has worked in this capacity knows that these are extremely scripted stops. These are tours that minute by minute are very well planned and scripted. So the fact that he's suggesting, or his office is suggesting, that they stumbled upon it is ludicrous. I agree with much of what's been said today. I mean, this is, and I kind of imagine that his sense of entitlement around what he's prepared to say is growing because he's far ahead in the polls, and I think he thinks that he has some license. But what is also coming through are a lot of true colors here. He'll say whatever he needs to say, stand with whoever he needs to stand with, cozy up to whoever he needs to cozy up to, despite the fact that they may be extremists, far-right groups, groups who want to overturn governments, freedom convoy protesters, doesn't seem, people who have objections to women's reproductive rights, doesn't seem to matter to him as long as he can get to the other side of a vote. So while I agree with Tim that I don't, you know, does this matter? You know, in the short term, maybe not. But I do think a bit of a narrative is forming. And I think that that can be problematic. This could be his Achilles heel. If he doesn't know his limits, if he can't rein it in, whether that's the hyperbole he uses or the people he's willing to stand with, I think it can bite him in an election.
So Justin, hanging over this is this bizarre endorsement that Pierre Poilievre got from Alex Jones that the liberals have seized upon. And Alex Jones is one of the kingpins of U.S. conspiracy culture, where he spews nonsense on a lot of his shows and has been found financially liable for the lies he spread about the massacre at Sandy Hook, suggesting children were never murdered by the gunman that day. And he has said, not on this issue, but on other issues, like in particular anti-World Economic Forum arguments, that Pierre Poilievre is saying the same thing as him. He says Pierre Poilievre is the right guy to be the Prime Minister of Canada. The Liberals have seized on this. Pierre Poilievre's office has not denounced Alex Jones or repudiated Alex Jones. He said, we don't follow that guy. We don't really know that guy. What do you make of this move? It seems like, if you can't condemn, Alex Jones seems like an easy condemnation.
Yeah, but, you know, I actually feel a bit of sympathy for Pierre Poilievre here. I mean, listen, there's two things going on, right? One is that Pierre Poilievre and the Conservative Party have courted people who have played into paranoid, delusional fantasies, like the idea of the World Economic Forum is some unique globalist evil, right? They have, to some degree, fed in to this paranoid populism that has taken root in parts of Canada. So the endorsement shouldn't be all that surprising. But also, we really do have to stop playing the game of, you know, denounce every single person who, you know, expresses positive feelings towards you, right? You know, I've never heard Pierre Poilievre say anything nice about Alex Jones, which is, you know, better than, let's say, Donald Trump, who, you know, used to go on his show. I don't think it's necessary that he denounce every single person who expresses sort of admiration of his political project. And frankly, I think the more we end up sort of debating you know, the merits of people like Alex Jones, the more we get away from the fact that, you know, there is some fundamental frustrations in this country, and they're looking to people like Alex Jones, and that's why they're popular, right? I think the more we get kind of caught up in the symbolism of Alex Jones, instead of talking about some of those underlying concerns, the more like people like Pierre Poilievre will say, tune out the news, tune out the media. It's no good. You may as well be listening to InfoWars. So, you know, it's a really tough thing to have a conversation about. It's frustrating. And Alex Jones is a nut job. He's an anti-Semitic loon. But, you know, I don't think that it helps Canadian politics to be debating whether or not Pierre Poilievre has adequately denounced him going forward.
Jordan, how do you see it? Because, you know, this is the big pushback from the Liberal. And Justin, I think you make a lot of really good points there. Jordan, how do you see it?
Yeah, I don't disagree with Justin on that. I think that, frankly, there's enough going on with Pierre Poilievre's engagement with this sort of conspiracy-driven group within Canada. Like, that is actually an issue here. And so I would actually say that I think, like, what worries me as a Canadian and as somebody who's really looked pretty closely at what's happened in Europe, where you see the far right has become very good at using mainstream political parties to advance their own agenda and to legitimize themselves and to take up more space in public discourse. And I think that we are not immune to those trends. And so I think there's really fair public good questions to be asked about federal leaders who engage with that, who legitimize it by their involvement with it. And I think that those questions to me are maybe like the most central ones that we should be looking at.
So Amanda, despite that, it seems like the Liberals are intent to push it, though, right? Do you think this is an effective play for them? Or is it, as Justin says, you're not responsible for who says nice things about you in the internet world of 2024?
Yeah, well, I agree with Justin, but this is politics. And in politics, you know, the ability to exploit these movements and to attach political leaders to them can be very powerful and very persuasive. So if you can suggest to an audience that, you know, Pierre Poilievre, for example, holds the same views as some far right lunatic, you know, that's powerful. People will start to question it, because at some point we ask ourselves, can I trust this person? Is this person like me? And these are the fundamental questions that people ask when they head into their ballot box at some point. So if the liberals concede over a period of time that he's not that like you, or that he believes in things that you just simply couldn't believe in, or that you can't trust him because he'll say one thing to one group and another thing to somebody else, or he won't denounce some really ugly, hateful views, that can be a powerful tool. So you have to understand it from both a political lens as well as a social lens.
Look, I agree with Justin on Alex Jones, first of all. Mm-hmm. He's a despicable racist idiot. So let's get that out of the way. I think, though, what is at play here, too, is the fact that on the liberal side, as Amanda said, why wouldn't they attack? Because on the other front, what they're trying to sell themselves is not taking hold. Sure. I mean, their budget isn't taking off. There's criticism of different initiatives. This is a bit of a gift for them. Maybe the prime minister goes and on their, you know, plan to win back 5 points every 6 months, maybe this gets them 0.13. Oh, no, that's the capital gains tax. But for Poilievre, what's interesting, too, here is, yeah, you swatted away a little bit. I get that. I go back to the other video, though. So that other video, he's, you know, Amanda's right in saying for years and years, a politician would say one thing in one region, one in another. Now you can't do that because it's all on film.
Yeah.
So the video of Poilievre going out there, some people will hear what we're saying is where that video was shot and why they should be offended. But there will be a whole other audience that will hear the derogatory messages about the prime minister. And while he shouldn't have used that language in that particular tone, will say, right on, man. So I think, again, he is calculating that he's got a lot of room to take risks. He's going to try them out right now. And while that may be offensive to many of us as the way you shouldn't do things, this is the game plan he's going to run out until such time as he discovers it's a car crash. And it may never be.
Yeah, Justin, just a final point. I don't think people are as offended by tone and profanity in the social
media.
You
say that to me in the break all the time.
Exactly. You know, that's why you have to say commercials. But, you know, I don't think it bothers people when you look at the way internet discourse culture is. I don't think it's the same sort of shocking thing as someone saying BS or the F word or whatever would have been 30 years ago and they holding public office. But sort of the creep of the ideas that, you know, percolate on the edges of conspiracy moving into mainstream politics, like the World Economic Forum, the global overreach of the UN, the World Health Organization, ivermectin, these things sort of moving into the middle of the mainstream is fundamentally changing the nature of politics. And I wonder if there is a political challenge there for the conservatives, or if it's just the evolution we're in right now and the way our politics works.
Well, I actually think it's a political opportunity for the conservatives, right? You know, to let their better angels govern and to find a way to harness that frustration that is very real and in some cases very legitimate, and to try and build a positive conservative, you know, political project out of it. Like, I think that's the opportunity Pierre Poilievre has. I don't think that's what he's doing. I think he's watching these conversations unfold. He's watching these grassroots movements pop up, and he's deciding to go play in the mud with them in many respects. And he's using their language, and he's feeding into it, and he's actually encouraging it in many ways, right? And the sign of a good politician is somebody who notices when politics has gotten too polarized, when people have really drawn a line in the sand and added up the score. And instead of adding to it and encouraging that sort of tribalism, finding ways to bring people together and to sort of sell a positive message. And I think Pierre Poilievre says he's doing that, but you listen to the guy. I mean, he's going out to these encampments where people are just irrationally angry. Even if, again, they might have legitimate grievances, they're irrationally angry, and he's telling them that everything's a lie. The government hates you. Everything's horrible. And it is going to lead to negative things in this country, including, by the way, if he actually ends up forming government. People are not going to suddenly become happy and sunny and optimistic just because Pierre Poilievre's in power. He's going to have to contend with that negativity and that frustration when he's in power and he doesn't fix everything overnight.
Okay. I enjoyed that. Thanks for agreeing to talk about that with me. We got to leave it there. We're out of time. Justin, thanks for joining us, man. Amanda, Tim Powers, Jordan Likens. Thanks so much, gang.
Thank you.
After months of tense negotiations and debate, U.S. President Joe Biden signed into law today a $95 billion aid package that will provide military assistance to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. But tucked inside that package is a provision that could lead to the banning of TikTok in the United States. TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, now has 9 months to sell the popular social media app or risk a ban in U.S. markets. TikTok's CEO said today that the company will be fighting the legislation in court.
Make no mistake, this is a ban. A ban on TikTok and a ban on you and your voice. We aren't going anywhere. We are confident and we will keep fighting for your rights in the courts. The facts and the Constitution are on our side.
Karim Bardizi has been following all of this. He's the executive director at the DAIS, a public policy think tank at Toronto Metropolitan University. Karim, it's good to see you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, David.
So when we last spoke, this ban was being contemplated, but now U.S. President Joe Biden has signed legislation that really starts the clock. There's a nine-month timer on TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, to sell the app, and we've seen they plan to fight this in court. How do you see this playing out?
Well, there's a bit of time left. Former President Trump has flip-flopped on his position, so I'm sure the Chinese authorities are hoping for a Trump victory and a reversal of that at the last minute. Trump would come out in favor of a ban, is now against it. So I'm guessing they're preparing for that while simultaneously probably looking for a buyer, looking for all the alternatives for them to not get dragged into this potential for a ban. I'm sure, you know, the real question is the Chinese government, which has a relationship, a controlling kind of relationship with these firms and the data that they have, are they willing to stomach a ban or not? And if not, then probably a compromise can still be reached. But otherwise, we'll see either a forced sale or a court proceeding on the same.
So on the court action that's being, I don't know if I want to say threatened or promised, but the argument will apparently include the right to free expression, and free speech online. And with the legal challenges and the injunctions it plans to seek, how likely is it that we actually see a decision in this nine-month time frame? Do you think it could drag on well past that?
Potentially, yes. I mean, observing some of the U.S. Supreme Court's take on these issues of late, they are... On one hand, a bit more suspicious of the power of these companies, but at the same time, really unwilling to be as interventionist, I think, as the Biden administration in particular wants them to be. So this is something that will definitely, the court process will definitely be part of this. You know, it really depends on whether there's an 11th hour resolution. But as you say, the train has now really left the station and there's only so many options. It seems unlikely that it would drag on past the deadline. These are the kinds of things that are sufficiently large that they will need to be resolved before the deadline.
Well, speaking of sufficiently large, you need very large bank accounts and very deep pockets if you want to buy something like TikTok. The valuation of tech companies is beyond my brain's ability to figure out, but how much is something like this worth? I mean, how practical would a sale even be?
TikTok, while ByteDance, the parent, while it doesn't have the valuation of some of the largest companies in the world, has some assets that make it comparable to, that make it in the league of some of these largest companies in the world. An algorithm that is really more powerful than any social media algorithm we've seen. You know, TikTok is referred to as a social media company, but it's really a broadcast company that's tailoring individual broadcasts to individual people. And they've got an incredibly powerful algorithm backed by a rich and growing set of data that is really the kind of assets that leads to the large valuation of some of these tech companies. So it's hard to say exactly where the valuation will land, but it won't be cheap. Even in a situation of for sale that would lower the value a little bit, these are still very rich assets. These are assets that are world leading.
So it's interesting to see the change in the timeline. We mentioned 9 months, which moves it past the U.S. election. Originally, the ban was going to be put in place before the November election. So what do you think of this shift in timeline? And if China and ByteDance aren't happy with this, the potential of TikTok to play a role in U.S. politics this fall?
Oh, and it's happening. It's happening in all kinds of ways. The Israel-Palestine conflict and the way it's playing out politically in the United States, is being driven in part by what people are perceiving as being highlighted on TikTok. So there's that element. There's the potential use of these videos, these very powerful AI-generated tools that can then migrate onto TikTok and be part of the public conversation election. So this isn't the last of it. You know, even as this official process plays out through legislation, through litigation potentially, through the markets, it's also going to be playing out in a public fashion because TikTok is a player in this election campaign.
You know, you've got ByteDance, which owns TikTok, going up against the U.S. government, you know, a powerful private sector commercial entity with Chinese connections going up against the U.S. government. You got 170 million Americans who are on that platform. You got 7 million American businesses that profit from that platform. Lots of Canadians do as well. I mean, what are the implications for people who make their living here and just use this? What the implications for the end user here?
So this is a very disruptive intervention that's being considered. But at the same time, it's important to remember one thing about technology, tech products, and the way that they relate to each other, and the way these companies relate to each other in particular. Some of ByteDance's main competitors, if you see it as a broadcast company and as a company that's primarily generating data and sharing online video, we know that some of the other major platform companies are very interested in this work. Mm. We know that Meta, the parent company of Facebook, has a strong interest in this area. We know that Google, the parent company of YouTube, has a very strong interest in this area. And we also know that even though these products are subject to strong intellectual property protections, that companies are trying to constantly mimic and develop the best versions of these products. So there's definitely going to be disruption if, in the extreme case, that a ban happens. But on the other hand, Don't be surprised if you see even more compelling versions of these products being rolled out by some of these other companies.
Okay. While we're watching this big political economic fight in the U.S., there are some interesting development on the issue of the online space here in Canada. We've seen British Columbia announce it was pulling back its proposed online harms legislation. They're putting it on hold after reaching an agreement with social media giants. What's your take on this development and this move by the BC government?
So this is a really kind of interesting achievement by the BC government. This is a subnational as part of a larger, this is a global conversation, and yet a province of a mid-tier country has managed to, in terms of population, has managed to reach this agreement with these platforms. Obviously, there's a federal piece of legislation as well, the Online Harms Act, which was going to achieve some of the things that the BC legislation is trying to do. And so some part of this, I think, is BC deferring to the federal legislation. This isn't typically an area that you'd have provincial jurisdiction, but there is obviously pressure on the BC government from the population to act in this area, to work to protect people online, especially children and members of visible minorities. And so it's an impressive achievement to have gotten the social media companies to be working with them on this online safety table. But at the same time, this is something that's still going to go through the Canadian legislature. And it's something that's going to have to be watched closely. Ultimately, this is an area where it's national and indeed international or U.S.-based policies that are going to have as big an impact.
Just quickly, Kareem, I wonder what your thoughts are with governments increasingly dealing with this, right? Because of the explosion of this sector, there's this regulatory lag. Do you think they're striking the right balance between protecting people and children in particular against the harms they can encounter online without stomping all over expression and speech rights?
Yeah, so at the dais, we had quite a bit of input into what the Online Harms Act and giving some advice on that publicly, and been doing surveys that show that Canadians have an appetite for regulation. The appetite for regulation is growing over time, and that these companies that are the subject of the regulation are amongst the least trusted companies in Canada. At the same time, though, Canadians are also users of these products. And the balance that is going to be struck is one that you can't trust government alone with, or indeed the platforms alone with. This is something where everyone who's a player on these platforms has some form of responsibility. Now, maybe that's being a bit too ambitious on behalf of users of platforms, that we all have a place to play in this regulation of the online public square. But it is true that we all have a role, and that legislation can only go so far. Yeah. I think the use of the legislation that we're seeing is because you have this growing public appetite and other tools as well. You know, we have lawsuits in Ontario with the four major Toronto school boards collectively suing the social media giants for the impact of this on children. We're seeing increasing research on the role of social media platforms in childhood and teenage development. And so it's that kind of stuff that is also part of this larger conversation, which is increasing the appetite for regulation.
Karim Bardizi, always appreciate the time. Thanks so much for joining me today. That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.